After writing about jazz for over 40 years, critic Dan Morgenstern finally has a book collecting his essays, reviews, and liner notes. It's called Living with Jazz, A Reader. In the New York Times Book Review, Alfred Appel wrote that Living with Jazz deserves to be on the short shelf of essential books on the music. Morgenstern has been an important figure as a critic, editor, and historian. During the 60s and early 70s, he edited Downbeat, and before that, he edited the magazine Metronome. Since 1976, he's been the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, one of the world's largest archival collections of jazz materials. Morgenstern was born in Vienna, where his father was the cultural correspondent for a German newspaper and had written critically of the Nazis. After the Nazis took over Austria, Morgenstern's father fled Vienna, but the young Morgenstern had scarlet fever and was too sick to travel. After recovering, he and his mother found safety in Copenhagen and then Sweden. The family reunited in New York after the war. I asked Morgenstern about his introduction to jazz as a child during World War II.
What got me, really got me involved, was seeing Fats Waller in Copenhagen in September of 1938. And, you know, that was a great experience. I had never seen anybody like that before. Well, there wasn't anybody like Fats Waller. You know. There never has been since. But he was so, you know, so vital and so overpowering in a way, you know, but he was physically very large. I had not seen many black people in my life before then, and he was, as he would say, mesmerizing.
Would you choose a record that you loved when you were young, during the war, when you were fleeing from the Nazis, a record that still means a lot to you?
Well, I guess, you know, this is, of course, a kid's record, but it's also, in retrospect, it's a good jazz record. That was Chick Webb's Dipsy Doodle, which featured a vocal by the then still very young, about 19-year-old Ella Fitzgerald. And then after the vocal, it had a tremendous trombone solo by Sandy Williams, whom I subsequently got to know after I came to this country. And that was just the record that I loved, and I particularly liked, you know, the nonsense lyrics. I knew some English, but not really a lot, but it has sort of silly lyrics, you know, and then that trombone solo afterwards. It was, you know, that's a record that I'm still very fond of.
Why don't we hear it?
The Dipsy Doodle is easy to find. It's almost always in the back of your mind. You never know it until it's too late, and then you're in such a terrible state. Like the moon jumped over the cowhead diddle. That's the way the Dipsy Doodle works. When you think that you're crazy, you're the victim of the Dipsy Doodle. But it's not your mind that's hazy, it's your tongue that is fault, not your noodle. Pretty doot, pretty doot, pretty old noodle. See you, dance, doodle. Dip, 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 dipsy doodle. You think you're crazy, the things that you say. Like rhythm got I and hot am I. That's the way the dipsy doodle works.
That's Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald, The Dipsy Doodle, a record that meant a lot to Dan Morgenstern when he was growing up. And now jazz critic, historian, and director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, Dan Morgenstern has a new collection of his writings, which is called Dan Morgenstern, Living with Jazz. In 1947, after the war, you and your mother moved to New York, where your father had already moved. What are some of your earliest memories of discovering jazz as a New Yorker and actually being able to go to concerts and go to record stores?
Well, I have this line that I've used a lot. I used it in my very subliminal appearance on Ken Burns's Jazz, which I had the pleasure. I was an advisor to that, but on screen I only appeared for about 10 seconds. But what I said is something that I've often said, which is that when I came to New York, you know, what I wanted was not to see the Empire State Building, but I wanted to see 52nd Street. 52nd Street, after all, was alive at night, you know, and I was still only 17, but I managed to get there, and to me, it was, you know, it was paradise. I mean, you could, one side of the street, you could hear Sidney Bechet, and across the street, you could hear Charlie Parker, and Billie Holiday was next door, you know, I mean, it was just an incredible place.
You've described yourself as having been more of a jazz journalist and jazz proselytizer than jazz critic. Would you choose a record that you feel you helped affect the destiny of, or helped change the attitude toward, a record that you loved that you thought wasn't really getting wasn't getting adequate attention, or wasn't really understood?
Well, one of the things that I found irksome was the attitude that then existed towards the work of Louis Armstrong. You know, people had a tendency to look at it in terms of the Hot Five era, you know, heebie-jeebies, and then jump to the All-Stars and Hello, Dolly. And everything in between was sort of being ignored. And to me and others as well, that was the, you know, some of the peak achievements of Mr. Armstrong. So in particular, I had a chance to do liner notes for a collection of wonderful material from the mid-30s that had more or less been neglected. And in particular, one thing that was on there was a piece by Armstrong himself called Swing That Music, which is just a wonderful demonstration of his awesome trumpet prowess, and also kind of reminded me in the way he punches out 42 high C's, you know, after the vocal, reminded me of the way Joe Louis punched out Max Schmeling. And I think I was able to bring that into better focus and kind of illuminate that aspect of Armstrong's artistry. And I'm happy about that.
Well, why don't we hear that Armstrong recording of Swing That Music, and this is from 1936?
Right.
My heart gives a chill. I feel such a thrill. My feet won't keep still when they swing that music. Rhythm like that puts me in a trance. Or you can't blame me for wanting to dance. From what I understand, it must be just grand to play in a band. When they swing that music, I'm just happy as can be. When they swing that music for me. Thank you.
That's Louis Armstrong. We'll hear more from Dan Morgenstern after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dan Morgenstern. Since 1976, he's directed the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. His reviews, liner notes, and essays are finally collected in a book. It's called Living with Jazz. Since 1976, you've directed the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. And in that sense, you've become really important as a collector of jazz history. The Institute is, I don't know, perhaps the most important collection of jazz history in the country, one of the most important in the world. What are one or two of the objects in the collection of the Institute of Jazz Studies that mean the most to you and that have an almost like magical aura surrounding them?
Well, I think that would be the instruments. We have quite a collection of instruments that belong to famous and maybe even not so famous musicians, and some of those people are people that I felt very close to. So those things represent a very tangible, you know, aspect of my own life with this music, such as, you know, Ben Webster's tenor, Lester Young's tenor, the one he used when he was with Basie, and we have odd things like plastic gardenia of Billie Holiday's when she couldn't get a real one. You know, she used that. And Billie was somebody that I just absolutely loved. And manuscript. We have a wonderful manuscript by Louis Armstrong. And we have, I don't know if I can use the expression tchotchkes, but we have things like we have an Ella Fitzgerald, a little sculpture made of spoons and forks, which actually represents her, you know, with a microphone in her hand. And that was sitting on her mantelpiece. She really liked that. And those things are special, you know. They have an aura.
One of the things that's interesting about your book is that it not only, you know, helps put jazz musicians in perspective and shares your critical views of them. There's some interesting personal history in it as you, review various concerts and records, and you're there at the moment these things are happening. And I thought I'd just read an excerpt of something you wrote about Ornette Coleman after seeing him in concert in 1958. So this is very early on in an Ornette Coleman's career. And I'm just going to excerpt a paragraph here. You write, "Whatever else Ornette Coleman may be, one cannot doubt the sincerity of his music. It is fiercely individualistic and makes no concessions to conventions, not even to those of modern jazz. That he takes his cue from Charlie Parker is unquestionable, but this is no imitator. Coleman's cohorts are obviously in full sympathy with his aims, and the unison work between his alto and Don Cherry's miniature cornet is thrilling because it sounds so free, yet obviously requires the greatest discipline." Then you go on to say, "The boys are serious, but not in the professional and vastly annoying manner of Miles Davis. There are occasional smiles, and what do you know? At the end of the set, Ornette Coleman makes an announcement in traditional style. 'Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and now we present the great Benny Golson Art Farmer Jazz Tet. Let's bring them on with a hand.'" I thought that was so funny that you're reviewing this like new controversial avant-gardist, and what catches your attention as well as the music is the fact that he's this real gentleman on the bandstand and very traditional in the way he welcomes on, you know, Art Farmer.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why I did that was, you know, at the time a lot of people were jumping on Ornette, you know, and he was really, you know, it was a storm of controversy, but nobody said that, you know, and I felt that was my impression the first time I saw them at the Five Spot, you know, that there was something really engagingly, you know, I wouldn't say unsophisticated, but unspoiled, you know. And this was the first time in New York, you know, and that was very, in some ways, very appealing. But, I think maybe I was the only one who, you know, who mentioned that. The other people were much too busy, you know, analyzing the music or trying to do that.
Well, Dan Morgenstern, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Dan Morgenstern directs the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. His new book is called Living with Jazz, A Reader.